Welcome again to our series of lectures on the Pope's Apostolic Exhortation, The Joy of the Gospel. And so we welcome you to the second of five lectures because the joy of the gospel, at least according to Francis, is made up of five chapters. So it is in that vein that I want to begin by locating things. Essentially, the purpose of my lecture tonight is to examine chapter 2 of the Apostolic Exhortation. Now, to some degree, chapter 2, not surprisingly, flows out of chapter 1. In chapter 1, as Father Connolly indicated last week and took us through a quite reflective analysis of evangelization, Francis is really asking in chapter 1, what kind of church do we need to be in order to evangelize? And so Father Connolly stressed the phrase of a renewal of the church that cannot be avoided or ignored. So what kind of church are we to be to evangelize? Chapter 2 examines what is the context of the world in which we are invited to evangelize. So in a sense, that will be a focus of mine tonight. Chapter 3 then moves on to how the gospel is to be proclaimed. So you can see that the first chapter and the third chapter, what kind of church should we be? How should we proclaim the gospel? Well, similarly, chapter 4 is the social dimension of evangelization. So what Francis does is in chapter 2, he admits, only some of the characteristics of the world in which we are called to evangelize. And then in chapter 4, he's going to be talking about what he thinks we ought to say to the world as it is. And to some degree, it's hard to separate 2 and 4, and I found that so as I prepared this lecture. And then chapter 5 looks at what the characteristics are of evangelizers that the church needs today, and he's calling on all of us to be evangelizers. So again, I'm concentrating on chapter 2, the context of the world in which we live, but it points toward chapter 4, how do we respond to that world? I'd like to make some opening remarks about Francis's vision, the sources of Francis's vision. Then turn to the context of the world and what he has to say about it. I think as we look at Pope Francis, not only in this one document, but in terms of the year we have lived through with him in the church, as we look at Francis, I find three major background themes that run through his teaching. Things that are subterranean, if you will, but are there and surface if you watch for them in his teaching. So the three things that I think are behind Francis's vision of things are, first of all, that he's a Jesuit. He has been a Jesuit, been formed as a Jesuit, even though to some degree you lose your identity of a religious community when you take on the episcopacy or the papacy. There's no doubt that we have a Jesuit pope, if you will. When he sets out to examine in chapter 2 what are the characteristics of the world in which we are called to evangelize, he says, I'm really not going to try and do this comprehensively. Secondly, I'm not going to try and do it like an academic sociologist giving you lots of data and numbers. He said, I would prefer to describe my approach as evangelical discernment. Now, any of you who know the language of Ignatius and Ignatian spirituality, the notion of discernment is a very central way in which Jesuits are taught to examine the world and which in turn they teach others. So Francis right away turns to a part of his life that has been central and in a sense wants us to be with him as he carries out this work of evangelical discernment. That's the first characteristic. I think we will again and again find that we have a Jesuit pope, and it will be manifest in the way he does and says things. Secondly, Francis is a Latin American bishop, has been a Latin American bishop for quite a long time now. And that means that he lived through the experience of the 1970s and 80s in Latin America, a quite brutal time for the life of the church and for the church understood as a community of people and not simply an institution. So this is the time in which in the 1970s you had authoritarian governments run by the military all over Latin America, Peru and Chile and Brazil and Argentina. And those authoritarian regimes did what authoritarian regimes do. They shut down lines of communication in society. They put the political opposition in jail. They shut down newspapers, shut down unions, and insofar as they were able, they tried to shut down the church. The church responded to that, reacted to that. Indeed, there was a profound shift of the church in Latin America in the late 1960s, the 70s, and the 80s. In a sense, if you looked at it in a certain way, it took you back to the earliest period of the apostolic church, when the church found itself face to face with the Roman Empire, and, if you will, claimed space in society and said not everything will be run by the state, particularly the state that rules by a gun. So he lived through that. He lived through a particular chapter of that church-state conflict, which in Argentina was called the Dirty War. And it was a quite extraordinarily difficult situation where people would, quote, disappear, and that those disappearances, many of them never solved till today. He lived through that period, had to make choices in the middle of it, was a Jesuit provincial before he was a bishop. And all of that, in a sense, is going to also be reflected in a bit of what he writes. He is a bishop, we know, from the south, as it is called today, from the southern hemisphere, the first bishop from the southern hemisphere in modern Catholic history. And that positioning of himself from the south generally and from Latin America specifically will run through his style of being pope. Now, this is not unique to Francis. Think of how powerfully the setting in which John Paul II functioned as a priest and a bishop in Eastern Europe, how powerfully that encounter with communism shaped his view of what the papacy and the church should be. So we find here, again, that every pope has a background, and now that we're drawing popes from outside Italy, outside Europe, from the global south for the first time with Francis, we see how those backgrounds interact with previous moments in the church's history. Thirdly, Francis is not only a Jesuit and a Latin American bishop, he's very much a bishop of the Second Vatican Council. Indeed, Francis is the first pope who was ordained after the Second Vatican Council, ordained as a priest and then as a bishop. So he lived through not only the events I've just talked about in social terms, he lived through what we've all lived through, that is to say, the great gift of the Second Vatican Council and the ferment that arose in the church on many sides as we tried to interpret the council over the last 50 years and are still trying to do so today. So I think, and I will try and point out at various points, where these three influences, in a sense, surface as he talks about the kind of church we should be and the kind of world we live in. So let me begin with the legacy of the Second Vatican Council. I entitled tonight's lecture, The Legacy of Gaudium et Spes, the last and longest document of the Council, the document that was entitled The Church in the World of Our Time. So Francis, I think, carries forward the legacy of the Council and that particular document, The Church in the World of Our Time. Now, Francis warns against worldliness in the Church. He warns against us being captured by the dominant themes in the secular culture. He wants us to discern those themes, to affirm some, and to resist others. And yet, he is also very much in favor of a church that lives in the world, that goes out into the world in many different ways. So it is a continuation of the document on the Church in the World of Vatican II. That document tried to do several things. It tried to stress, as Francis has, that the church was given a task by Jesus that is a task that includes trying to shape and influence the major characteristics of the world in which we live. Francis, in chapter 4, says that evangelization always has a social meaning and content. Evangelization is not only about inviting individuals and communities to convert to the gospel and live the faith, but evangelization is meant to try to shape the very structures of the world in which we live. The way he describes that is in the style of Gaudium et Spes, or the document from the Council. He says the social dimension of evangelization is about the idea of the kingdom. Now, the kingdom is the phrase that we find on the lips of Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And he keeps talking about the fact that he has come to bring the kingdom into history. That is what his preaching is about. That's what the various miracles are about. They are to be signs of the kingdom. Jesus was often asked, well, what is the kingdom like? Where is it? How do we find it? And the question that came to Jesus came from people who thought of the kingdom in a political sense, who thought of it as a given place and a given location, if you will. And Jesus, of course, always resisted that notion and said, I have not come to found a political kingdom. And so they would say, well, what have you come to do then? What is the kingdom if it's not a thing, if it's not a place? And he would say, well, the kingdom is like light in darkness. It's like leaven in a loaf. It's like salt in your food. Well, what does that mean? Well, the kingdom is like a power. It is like a power brought into the history of the world. It is the power of the life and love of God set forth by the ministry of Jesus. And that power runs through history. It interacts with the secular history of the world. Think of the vision of leaven in the loaf. The power is meant not to destroy the secular characteristics of the world, but to direct and guide them, hopefully, into the vision that God has for the world. That power meets resistance often. Francis will tell us about that. That power, however, has the capacity to engage the secular aspects of life and give them a direction, purpose, and meaning they never can produce by themselves. So Francis thinks of the evangelizing task as extending to the characteristics of the world in which we live. And again, following the document on the church in the world, if you think of the kingdom as Jesus's gift to the world, and you think of secular history as that which has to be leavened and permeated by it, between those two things, the kingdom and the world, stands the church. And the Second Vatican Council said the church is the instrument of the kingdom in history. Now, what it meant by that is not that all of the work of the kingdom is done by the church. Rather, the vision is that the work of the kingdom can be done by many people, some of whom are not aware of thinking of their work as a work of the kingdom, but are thinking of trying to humanize the world, give it a moral foundation and direction. But even though the work of the kingdom can go on and does go on outside the church is meant to be that community of people who, through their faith in the Lord Jesus and understanding his teaching and seeking to follow it, have a conscious sense that they are meant to not only live out their life of faith, they are to influence the world. Francis tells us that all of the evangelizers and the preaching and teaching of the church is meant to impact history, and he's quite explicit about that. So Francis starts, I think, from his assessment of the world, from the grounding that we have in the document on the church in the world. Indeed, he connects his letter to that document by saying that this evangelical discernment that he's trying to make of what's going on in the world, he talks about that as examining the signs of the times. A phrase that you find in the gospel, signs of the time, and a phrase that was central to the text from Vatican II. Again and again, the text from Vatican II said, the task of the church is to examine the signs of the times and interpret them in the light of the gospel. So this is very much a connection between that text and what Francis is about. When he talks about the church and its work, again, he stresses broader themes from the Second Vatican Council. He stresses the theme of collegiality, how he is in relationship with the bishops throughout the world in this evangelizing task. He says the Pope should not give all the answers to questions of our day. We need to rely upon the local churches throughout the world to do their work of discernment about their situation. And then he liberally quotes from statements of bishops from Africa, Asia, the United States, Europe, in which they are speaking about the challenges they face in evangelization. He lifts them up and puts them into the context of his wider teaching. So on the basis of theology, and you might say theory, I think Francis is located strongly within the vision of the Church of Vatican II, especially the church in the world. But I think he goes one step beyond that. As he approaches what this public evangelization is about, evangelization of society, at least as I read him, I think it goes beyond a theoretical statement. As I read him, this is early on. This is 1 year into a papacy, so I'm willing to say I'll be glad to stand up and confess my faults in 2 more years if I've been wrong, and there's likelihood we might be. You think of being a physician for a year. Think of being a scientist for a year. Think of being a parent for a year. There's a little learning that goes on after the first year, and so it is with the papacy and our understanding of it. So I do think, however, that beyond the theological link to Gaudium et Spes, what Francis is trying to do is to build what I would call a pastoral, practical conception of the church, which will make it capable of responding to the signs of the time, of witnessing to the gospel and proclaiming it in the world. Now, if you think of some of the phrases that have most caught the attention of people, those phrases are examples of what I mean by a practical, pastoral vision of the church. He said the church should be like a field hospital in the midst of a battlefield. So that's what we ought to think about ourselves then, in which the wounded of the world are those we reach out to. He's talked about a church that goes outside its doors, doesn't wait for people to come and invite it out, goes outside its doors and searches out what he calls the peripheries of life. And I take that to mean various kinds of human needs, from large social questions to individual people struggling with questions of faith and life. A field hospital, a church that moves out beyond itself. He talks about resisting a conception of the church that is self-introspective all the time and is focused outward. Seeks to build, I think, a practical conception of the church that gets it ready for engaging the world. So, how does he get to his description of the world in chapter 2? Well, here in chapter 2, he tends to outline what he sees as major problems. He gives very few answers on how to deal with them. So that's why you kind of have to wait for chapter 4. I'm just getting you ready to live with frustration, okay? Because chapter 2 doesn't tell you really very much about what he's very upset about. We know he's very upset, but we're not quite sure what the game plan is if we stay just with chapter 2. Chapter 2 has two dimensions to it. First of all, there are the characteristics of the world in which we live, and he says these must be examined because they contain some themes that have the potential for dehumanization of people's lives. And therefore, he is clear that it is the church's obligation to engage some of these major themes. Secondly, chapter 2 talks about challenges and temptations which evangelizers face today. And here he says, I'm talking about everybody from bishops down through people who do the most concrete, detailed work in a parish or in a diocese. He said, I'm talking about the kind of temptations and challenges which any evangelizer faces. I'm going to spend most of my time on the characteristics of the world, and I'll tell you why later. But how does he see things? Well, he says in his mind, we are at what he calls a turning point in history. What does he mean by that? He says, well, on the one hand, if you look at the world we live in, you cannot fail to praise and welcome many of the advances of mind and heart and skill which have been built into the modern world. He said they are symbolized by the advances in science and technology, but they extend to other fields which open new possibilities for humanization of the planet. Now, that was very much the tone of Gaudium et Spes. Gaudium et Spes was a very sort of hopeful, affirming document. Some people argued that it helped the church come to terms with what is generally called modernity. That is to say, help the Catholic Church to review its posture and respond, not totally differently, but somewhat differently, to intellectual developments arising out of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, to political developments like democracy, to further developments like religious freedom. And so the idea was that Gaudium et Spes turned out to be a fairly positive assessment of those circumstances. Now, I have to tell you, Father Connolly and I have had dialogues about this for a long time, because I fell in love with Gaudium et Spes when he was teaching me in the seminary. And he always, I think, thought I might run off with that document and leave the other 15 behind. And so he once told me, after I was telling him of the wonders of Gaudium et Spes, he said, yes, but he said, we may need another document in the church. It's called Tristitia et Desperatio, which is sadness and desperation, as opposed to Gaudium et Spes, joy and hope. So there is, of this document, a critique that oftentimes it was too optimistic. So Francis now, And this really is the bishop from the south. Francis says, in addition to those characteristics, there are other features which must be resisted because they are so detrimental to human welfare. But they're very much part of our existence today. Now, Gaudium et Spes and Vatican II ended in 1965. In 1985, John Paul II called a special synod of bishops, a sort of mini-gathering of the bishops of the world, again, bishops from every country, to review where we'd been over the last 20 years. And one of the characteristics that came through those debates was the bishops from the South, who had lived through these very difficult circumstances that I've talked about, and of course, most of whom lived in situations of substantial poverty in the Southern Hemisphere, Africa, Latin America, and parts of Asia. And so they said, basically, we don't ever want to forget the cross. We don't ever want to forget the cross because the cross will always be with us. And they were stressing what you might call a more realistic view of the world. So Francis reflects both of these things. He argues there are parts of the world that should be affirmed and the church should welcome them as a gift and all of us should do so. There are other parts of the world that is not the, that should not be simply accepted at all. So this makes up for his view of the turning point, that there is this mixed picture out there. And remember, as he puts it, as we celebrate the achievements of science, technology, and the social sciences, our ability to analyze the world, so we need to remember that many of our fellow citizens live as marginalized people in the world. Now, the statistics are clear. There are 7 billion people in the world. There are 2 billion people that live on less than $2 a day. So he's got a case to make in terms of the setting in which he addresses it. The next thing to look at, as he describes the world, is his style of address. All the way through this letter, it is a thoroughly biblical letter. It is a thoroughly biblical language that is used to describe situations and to describe responses to these situations, at least in the social part of the letter. So it's thoroughly biblical. Secondly, it's biblical in a certain dimension of the Bible. It is the language of prophets. It is the language of Amos and Hosea and Isaiah and Jeremiah. Now, prophets tend to render broad, sweeping judgments. Prophets are usually not interested in long discussions of persuasion. They are there to tell you what is wrong and why you ought to change it, like yesterday. And they do not spend a lot of time on footnotes. Prophets do not worry about that. They feel their job is to speak to your heart and shock you, and therefore call for a different kind of judgment. His style of address, most of the time, is that of the prophet. And I'll have more to say about that a little bit later. When he gets to the challenges of the day, there are two parts. There are socioeconomic challenges and there are cultural challenges. So, the socioeconomic challenges. Here is the prophet. He says we should say no to 4 things that are visible in the world today. We should say no to what he calls an economy of exclusion. Secondly, we should say no to the idolatry of money. Thirdly, we should say no to a financial system that rules rather than serves people. And fourthly, we should say no to inequality, which then leads to violence, and then the poor are blamed for their condition. Now, have these topics been addressed before in Catholic teaching? Actually, yes, quite often. Have they been addressed in his way and have they made the impact that his statements have made? Now, impact here doesn't necessarily mean that everybody agrees with what he says. Impact is that people say, my God, there's an issue there, even if I think he's overstated it or hasn't given me a good answer. So there is in Francis here, there is in his approach to the social questions and the vision of the day, there is continuity with his predecessors, but there is difference. And the difference is the prophetic style and the way he presses an issue. He obviously has found a way to talk a language that those who are not schooled in church language or Catholic language or religious language still can hear the message. He has found a way to say things with an edge that many people find at least worth stopping to look at. Any of you who read The Economist regularly, the British magazine, will find in this week's Economist a very long article on Francis, much longer than at least I find unless they're doing a special. Now, The Economist magazine has stood for years as thoroughly lodged in the liberal, capital L, economic order. Free markets, open trading, etc. Very much in that style of argument. They go through Francis's critique, and they do not do what the economists can do when they disagree with you, which is to cut your head off. And it just doesn't do that. They sort of acknowledge what he says. And so there is a magazine that has a very definite economic style, a willingness to listen. Secondly, The Economist on the whole, up until very recently, has not treated religious voices in the public realm with much attention. On the whole, the idea was that religion doesn't really have much to say. Now, that has shifted in recent years. Recent editors of The Economist have written a book about the revival of religion in the world. But once again, the treatment of this religious figure who has taken on the economy of exclusion, the financial system, the idolatry of money and inequality gets treated on the whole with a fair amount of respect. So what does he mean by each of these? And again, his treatment is broad and sweeping. So what does he mean by the economy of exclusion? He says, well, everything today is governed by the laws of competition and survival of the fittest. These are the things that shape economic life. Now, that is a kind of Darwinian critique of the economy, but that's his. He opens with that. He says, He says, for example, why is it in our world that a homeless man who dies in the streets doesn't get any attention in the press, but 2 points of movement in the market get all kinds of press? Well, I think he knows why that happens, but he's trying to use the style of the prophet to say, there are these things that clash before us. He moves further into his view of exclusion. He says, masses of people find themselves marginalized and without work. Now, his focus on work is similar to John Paul II. The Catholic view of work is not only that we work to make a living, but that part and parcel of our dignity as God has created us is, as John Paul II said, we were made to work. Indeed, he used to talk about God's work and our work. And his argument was that our work meant that we were co-creators with God. That's a phrase that did not ring well with many Protestant theologians who didn't have as exalted a conception of human nature. I was once on a panel with a quite visible Protestant theologian, Stan Hauerwas, who taught at Duke, and we were discussing the letter on work by John Paul II, and where John Paul II says that we are co-creators with God. Stan Hauerwas entitled his paper, Co-Creation, Thoughts on a Bad Idea. So that was his view of the papal teaching, that we were co-creators with God. But there is this sense that work is not only about making a living, but to deprive someone of work, or the inability of a society to provide jobs with living wages, is to undercut the dignity of the human person. Now, we have a lot of folks in this country who have been on long-term unemployment, and undoubtedly that's an economic fact. But if you think of it from this other angle, it is also the kind of impact that can erode human dignity, person's sense of themselves, in their family, in their community. So he goes on. He says, in this economy, people are marginalized. Now, he spends some time on this. He says, basically, I don't mean by marginalized, they're just poorer than other people in the society. But he said, I think we've created an economy that at times people aren't even regarded as part of the society. His language is, he said, they're treated as outcasts in the society because they are not economically productive, and that's in part because they can't work. He then goes on, He then goes on to one of the statements that proved fairly controversial in the minds of some people. So he says, in the context of this economy of marginalization of a large number of people, obviously not everybody by any means, he says a significant percentage of the society has done well, but a larger percent. Now, he's looking at this globally and to some degree internally, but he doesn't make those distinctions. So the gaps within different societies differ. But again, having argued that there is such a thing as an economy of exclusion and marginalization, he says the following. He says, in this context, some people continue to defend trickle-down theories, which assume that economic growth, encouraged by a free market, will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system. Now, that is going to get you a fight on any street corner. I mean, in the West, anyway, because there are going to be all kinds of arguments that this economic system has, as can be demonstrated, has an enormous ability to produce aggregate wealth. He obviously is talking about the outcome of aggregate wealth and how it impacts others. But again, that phrase drew a fair amount of commentary. As some of you know, one of the leading radio hosts in the country said this document is simply Marxism, period. To which the Pope said, Marxism's wrong, but I knew a lot of good Marxists in my day, so I don't feel insulted by being called one. So he's already gotten himself into this flow, if you will. So that's a flavor of the economy of exclusion. Now, he says, the next thing is, he says, there is a new idolatry. We've created a new golden calf, and he uses that phrase, he uses that comparison. And he calls it the idolatry of money. He says, the causal factor behind the economy of exclusion is that we have created, as he calls it, an impersonal economy lacking human purpose. He talks about the dictatorship of an impersonal economy. Now, that's an interesting phrase because his predecessor had talked about the dictatorship of relativism, particularly in the West. And what Benedict was talking about is the world of ideas, that there are arguments out there that there are no universal objective truths, but that each culture and each place and maybe each person determines his or her own truth. and the ability to say there are universal truths that bind us all is not there. Benedict talked about the dictatorship of relativism. Francis talks about the dictatorship of what he calls the impersonal economy. The outcome of this, he says, is increasing inequality. And again, he goes back to fairly purple phrases. He says, this increasing inequality is due to an ideology which, quotes, defends the autonomy of the market and financial speculation. And so he says, a new tyranny is born, invisible and often virtual, which unilaterally and relentlessly imposes its own laws and rules. Now, he's making an argument there's a kind of iron grid out there that is very hard to modify, and yet its outcome, in his eyes, requires modification. So, he says, no to an economy of exclusion, no to the idolatry of money, no to a financial system that rules and serves. Now, clearly, the background here is the financial crisis of 2007-2008, which moved across the world to some degree, although the Latin Americans did better during it than others. But his argument is that he says we must come to a conclusion that money should serve, not rule, in human affairs. And he says, in the economic and financial world, he feels there's been what he calls a rejection of ethics and of God. So he makes an interesting statement here. He says, ethics leads to a God who calls for a committed response which is outside the categories of the marketplace. Now, one of the things he's doing here is to distinguish moral language from religious language. And that's going to be interesting as the letter goes on, because essentially he's saying there's such a thing as ethics that you can come to on reasonable, rational terms. Religious language is explicitly religious from beginning to end. But, he says, if we think in terms of ethics, sooner or later, he thinks, this will lead us to the vision of God and God's vision of the world. Now that's going to meet some other resistance. Clearly, there are any number of people in a society like ours that spend a lot of time thinking about ethics in this society and what we ought to be as a society in terms of justice and truth and compassion. Those people do not end up thinking about God. They end up thinking about a moral universe in which God, in a sense, is absent because usually it is not part of their experience or conviction that God exists. Francis argues that if you think about ethics long enough, you get to God, and you get to a God that will give you a vision in terms of which an impersonal economy can be reshaped. Or so that is his argument. Finally, there is no to inequality. So the fact of inequality, obviously, is much discussed today. There was a survey in the Boston Globe about 2 weeks ago that argued in terms of American society, the gap between, usually they use the highest quintile of society and the lowest, the gap between those, the Boston is fourth on the list of the widest gap in the country. So it's an issue that you can certainly find discussed in the United States. People agree on the inequality factually, disagree mightily about what ought to be done about it. And so Francis says, when a society at any level, local, national, or global, when a society is willing to leave some people on the fringes, no amount of surveillance or enforcement, coercion, is a guarantee of tranquility. So he, again, goes back to exclusion, inequality, and the need to change. Now, all of those four things are worth a seminar's debate, and in a society like ours, we'll get a seminar's debate. So we need to recognize that this is the opening of an argument that he has opened up. Let me give you some just comments on what lies behind this and comments on his way of stating things. Now, my main point is to present him, but I think I only reasonably can present him by trying to give you some sense of what reaction he will get. This is different than talking about the Trinity. You are here talking about marginal tax rates, talking about fiscal policy, monetary policy, the state of the economy. He is into the midst of these things by just saying what he just said. So, what's the background here? Well, I think there's an empirical background to his remarks, and there's a religious background. The empirical background, as I said, to some degree, the proximate empirical background is the financial crisis and the recession of the last 6 years, roughly, and the degrees of inequality that people talk about globally and nationally. That's the empirical background. Now, again, it is one thing to state the fact. It's another thing to ask, what do you do about it? And we'll get to Chapter 4, but Chapter 4 doesn't tell us everything either, to be honest, but it is there. Now, his religious background in addressing what he has addressed is very much a bishop from the South. The experience of living in what has been called for many years now developing societies and their place in an increasingly globalized world. Now, that's a mixed picture. Globalization, as I'll indicate in a minute, globalization has produced a significant amount of wealth in a number of countries. But it often can do that and widen inequality within a country even as it produces aggregate wealth. As one person said in a lecture not long ago, there is now much less poverty in absolute terms in China. There is more inequality in China than there was under Mao. So that Mao kept things at a certain level, but there was no kind of progress to a modern economy. Now that China has turned in that direction, they've lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. It is an amazing accomplishment. They have also expanded the inequality in Chinese society. So there's a huge debate in Chinese society about whether there's been moral regression even as there's been enhancement of living conditions. So this is a bishop from the South, the experience of the last 30 years. The experience of Latin American countries, including Argentina specifically, the experience in the 1970s and early 80s of the so-called third world debt, where developing countries went into deep debt, and the question was how that was going to be dealt with. And there were movements in the North arguing for debt forgiveness or debt lessening, which produced some movement on that front, but it also placed a significant burden on those countries. This is a bishop who's lived in the midst of that. It is also a bishop from Latin America who, as I said, lived through struggles about human rights and economic justice. Now, I said that these themes had been treated before, but not treated in Francis's style. So what do I mean by that? Well, for a moment, let me compare John Paul II with Francis on two questions. The role of the market in an economy, and the fact of globalization. These are two large questions. I mean, part of the argument of the 90s was everybody was moving toward a market economy. It was called the neoliberal synthesis, that is to say, democracy and markets. And factually, that was true for a large part of the world. So if you look at the evaluation of the market, the idea of the market, in terms of Catholic social teaching, what do you get? Well, in fact, there's always been a certain suspicion in Catholic social thought about simply allowing the law of supply and demand determine how you deal with economic reality. So if you go back as long ago as the late 19th century to Leo XIII when he was in the 1890s writing an encyclical to address the first wave of industrialization. Leo XIII argued that in terms of the wages someone should be paid, you cannot rely only on the laws of the market. So his argument was, if you rely only on the laws of the market, too often what people will be paid doesn't provide what Catholic teaching has called a living wage or a just wage. So Leo argued, and all his successors argued, for a modification of the laws of the market by determining what a decent standard of living should be and what kind of just wages would get you there. Now, we have debates about that today in terms of the minimum wage. There are debates going on around the country nationally. There's a debate here in Massachusetts. The minimum wage bill was passed by the Senate. It sits in the House. There are debates all around it. At the national level, there are full-page ads in the New York Times for and against a rise in the minimum wage. But my point is not the numbers. My point is that what you get from the church is a suspicion that the laws of the market are adequate to produce justice in the society. So there was that suspicion. Along comes John Paul II, who had lived under communism and then becomes Pope. And what does he have to say? Well, he said two things. He said two things. He said the laws of the market have about them positive aspects, or a market economy has about it positive aspects. He said it invites people to innovate, so the human spirit grows. He said, secondly, it protects people from the power of the state to govern their life economically as well as politically. He says it promotes innovation, it protects freedom, and it provides for a sort of pluralism in society where all the power isn't in one hand, namely in the hand of the state. However, John Paul II said, having said that, he said, while there are aspects of the market that are positive and should be recognized, the laws of the market by itself may produce efficiency. It does not guarantee justice. So once again, you get the same argument that the laws of the market may help you with aggregate wealth, may help you in many ways, but the fact of the matter is it will not guarantee justice. So he argued that you should try to design a social and economic system that let the market function, but not without any restraint or direction from other sources in society. So he said there should be what he called a juridical framework, we would call it policy, around the market to both let it function, but not let it function without restraint, because it won't guarantee justice. Now, Francis, as you heard, talks in much more critical terms about the market in his evaluation of it. Globalization. John Paul II essentially had an approach to globalization similar to his approach to the market. So he said globalization should not be treated like a fact of nature. We can't do anything about it. It's just going to sweep over us. Now, if you read Tom Friedman in the New York Times, you sort of feel it is going to sweep over you, and he's glad it is. He says globalization is integration further, faster, and farther of economic resources around the world. Well, John Paul says, no, it shouldn't be treated as a force of nature. Moreover, he said, it's not simply economic. Globalization has cultural and political consequences that need to be attended to. So he argued, for example, coming from Poland, which was struggling with a post-communist economy, he says globalization should not be allowed to destroy the culture of a country. Now, Francis is very similar to that. So, on the market and globalization, is there some continuity? Yes. Are there some differences? Yes. I think the difference is that Francis is more suspicious of globalization than John Paul II, and more suspicious that the market can be shaped in a way that produces the kind of justice you need. John Paul II seems to think both of those things can be done. So we come then to this prophetic style, and I'm here in the realm of commentary, as I promised you, but let me give you a sense. Let me take a quote from chapter 4 of Francis's letter, where again he is talking about the economy generally and economics generally. So he's really talking about the role of the church to promote both mercy and almsgiving to those in need. And he has quotes from the letter of St. James, which is very prophetic in style, about rich and poor and how we need to respect each other irrespective of characteristics in the economy. So he quotes James, he quotes Deuteronomy, and then he says this, Francis says this. He says, this message is so clear and direct, so simple and eloquent, that no ecclesiastical interpretation has the right to relativize it. The church's reflection on these texts ought not to obscure or weaken their force, but urge us to accept their exhortations with courage and zeal. Why complicate something so simple? Now, he's just quoted very strong statements about our obligations to create a just society. And then he says, this message is so simple, why modify it at all? Well, Catholic social teaching has drawn lots of distinctions. When we talk about justice, we talk about different levels of justice. One kind of justice between persons who make a contract with each other. Another kind on how the state should distribute benefits and burdens in a society. Another kind that does what Francis is doing, looking at the broad system of economics. So we've used these distinctions in the past. Is Francis the prophet going to need those distinctions to both defend what he has said and maybe to explain what he has said? In other words, while he speaks in prophetic discourse, is that going to be his last word and a sufficient word? Or is he going to face objections where he has to go back and say, well, I meant this and not that. I meant this far and not that far. It is really an open question, I think, because he has a very strong biblical message without the kinds of distinctions that are normally there. Final point, and then I'll take your question. Final point, he goes beyond the economy to talk about cultural conditions in the world which challenge evangelization. And so he says this happens all over the world with differences in different cultures. So what are the things that he worries about? First of all, he says religious freedom is threatened in the world today. Now, we've had a debate in the country, in this country, about these mandates for our social service agencies, but that is not unimportant, but it's a narrowly defined debate. He is talking about, I feel sure, religious freedom in Nigeria, religious freedom in Saudi Arabia, religious freedom in states that don't allow religious freedom. And so he talks about the threat to religious freedom that exists in states that hold very tightly how religious expression will occur. And there's a vast continuum of different examples. A place like Indonesia, for example, they authorize 5 religions. Now, we happen to be one of the 5, but if you're not one of the 5, you're not in good shape. And today, in places like Nigeria, where you have Christian-Muslim conflict, where the Christians are taking it pretty much on the chin, and then you have a place like Central Africa, the Central African Republic. Some of you will remember Father Nestor, who was with us during the summer some years ago. Father Nestor, at a quite young age, has been made a bishop in the Central African Republic. That is one of the poorest places in the world. It is right in the center of Africa, one of the poorest places in the world. It is also a divided society between Christians and Muslims, and the Muslims were pretty much beating up on the Christians until the Christians turned the tide, and now they're beating up pretty badly on the Muslims. And the religious leadership is together in trying to promote peace, but it is not simple. So religious freedom as threatened is a concern. He says, if we're trying to evangelize, we're going to run into this in certain circumstances. Perhaps something that's closer to us is, he says, in other society, there has been a kind of secularization which has occurred. And by that, what he means is an argument that says religion ought to be free, everyone ought to be free to choose to believe or not believe. But what religion ought not to be is public. Religion ought not to be a voice in the public policies of the society. Religion ought not to have a public role. Religion should exist, should be protected, but should be private. Francis, along with all his predecessors, argues against that. Today, in our society, we're a kind of curious mix between a strong secular voice, particularly in the courts and in the academic life, and a pervasively religious society in terms of the citizenry. So that's a second theme. He says, thirdly, there is this culture of relativism. That often goes with the secularization theme. In other words, the argument, is there a possibility of people from different religions, different backgrounds, to agree upon basic moral principles by which a society can and should be governed? He says there is today opposition to that argument. And then finally, he comes back again to this idea that globalization can threaten cultures that are not strong and can be swept away. So that's the sort of framework he gives about the world. And he closes with a strong stress on the need to evangelize culture. He said we shouldn't dismiss in the West the way, even when the West has become more secular, we shouldn't dismiss that beneath the secularization there still lives a kind of basic religious foundation. He calls it Christian foundation. And he says we shouldn't overlook that that's there, but we should understand that evangelization is not only about evangelizing people, but about evangelizing law and policy and framework. Now, that doesn't mean that religion dictates those things in a democracy. It means that the idea that religion is private is to be resisted, and that we ought to use a dialogue form in the society with religion as one voice. I'm leaving out the challenges to the evangelizers, because there it's the spiritual director who comes into play and talks about the characteristics people need to evangelize. I think that will fit nicely into chapter 5. And besides, I've already gone over my time. So we'll cease and desist here, and I'll be glad to take your questions.